Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. Hi, it's the Capital Connection. Joining us this week is David Lombardo, host of the Capital Press Room, also host of WCNY's public affairs television program, Connect New York. He knows all about New York State government and politics, and he's such a smart guy. I love talking to David Lombardo. Welcome to the Capital Connection.
Thanks for having me again, Dave. I'm going to have to take you around everywhere I go and just build me up. Quite an introduction.
As a friend used to say to me when I would say nice things about him, spread the word. Well, we're spreading the word today. Let's start with probably the biggest thing, the most impact on New Yorkers, which is the state budget. And we are into March now, which means the deadline, the end of March, is coming quickly. What are some of the major issues?
So I think the major issues are really outside of the fiscal realm this year, because the state has a lot of money, although there's an element of ambiguity surrounding federal support, which we can get to. But on the policy side, one of the big things the governor is pushing this year and has been talking about for months now is expanding the use of involuntary commitments. And the legislature, particularly some of the progressives in the Democratic majorities in the Assembly and Senate, have balked at this idea. And I think what we'll see in the final weeks of budget negotiations, which, as you said, is due at the end of March, but likely won't be wrapped up until sometime in April, if not later, there will be some sort of focus on what that language actually looks like as they try to address public safety concerns, mental health needs, as well as the civil rights of the New Yorkers who might be affected by this. Then I mentioned the ambiguity over the fiscal side of things. Right now, Governor Hochul, as she's proposed her budget, has really tried not to respond to the chance that the federal government might dramatically shake up the support it gives to New York. And this is a lot of support. I believe about $93 billion is anticipated in the coming fiscal year. And if any of that is jeopardized, then New York needs to either consider backfilling that money, which we can do to a certain extent, or potentially cutting programs that we might have otherwise expected to fund with federal dollars.
Yeah, one of the big ones is Medicaid, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And Medicaid is one of the largest areas of the state budget. It's funded basically by a share of federal dollars and state support, as well as some local support. And even a 1 or 2% change in what the federal government gives us, that's billions of dollars and would require some serious tinkering in our state budget. At this point in the process, it doesn't seem like the Assembly, the Senate, or the governor is inclined to pass a budget that backfills any of this money. And so it's possible we could see the legislature having to return sometime during the fiscal year, which runs from April 1 of 2025 to March 31st of 2026, to adjust the state budget spending plan to respond to potential cuts at the federal level to something like Medicaid.
Yeah, there are other big financial issues. We're hearing about the Chips and Science Act, which the president of the United States went after, and the issue of congestion pricing in New York City.
Yeah, congestion pricing and funding for the MTA overall remain a big sticking point here in New York. Obviously, the president has voiced his opposition to the congestion pricing system that's been put in place since January 5th. The governor, as well as proponents of the toll in the Manhattan Business District, have indicated and are actually in court to defend this system, a system that, in addition to addressing congestion, is supposed to be raising money that the MTA can borrow against to fund some of its capital projects. In addition to this money, though, there's a question of other capital project needs for the MTA, and the transit officials in New York City are hoping that they can get billions of additional dollars in capital funding as part of this year's budget. Whether state lawmakers will be able to find the money in the couch cushions to fund something like that remains to be seen, given how we had a recent revenue forecasting meeting where the budget officials from the governor's office and the Assembly and Senate get together and they rejiggered how much money they think we have to spend. I think the number was about $500 million. That's not going to cut it for the MTA. So one of the things that we might see debated in the final days of this budget process is whether there's going to be some sort of increased taxes probably targeted in the MTA region to fund some of the additional capital needs of that system.
Or as the speaker, Carl Hasey, said, revenue raises, right? They like to say it that way, not taxes.
Yeah, revenue raisers are the parlance here in Albany, I think in part because they want to make it seem like it's revenue for the sake of spending. And, anytime you can obfuscate the word taxes or fees is always a good one in the minds of the politicians who are advancing those so-called revenue raisers.
We're speaking with David Lombardo. He is the host of the Capitol Press Room, WCNY. And the issues are so many, David. I can go in a thousand different directions here, but let's stick with New York City for a second, because I noticed, and we spoke about this just a moment ago, public safety being a big issue, obviously. The Republicans have hammered the Hochul administration for this issue, and specifically going after the problems in the New York City subway system. Hochul now came out in a press conference touting the progress in fighting transit crime. This is a year after rolling out a subway safety plan, and they're saying it's having an impact. Some thoughts here now. That before that, it was attacks on bail reform, and cities, they're saying, were riddled with violence, and some of that seems to be exaggerated, but other things certainly are the perception of New Yorkers.
Yeah, what you just said at the end there is what really matters, the perception of New Yorkers. You can look at broad statistics about violence, and you can see positive trends in New York City and the state more broadly as it pertains to violent crime, retail theft, crime more broadly. But if you read a story in the local tabloid, or you see something in the news, or you just hear about it informally, that's something that really resonates with you, maybe more than the governor doing a press conference touting statistics. And I think Democrats, for the last couple years now, in the wake of the 2022 gubernatorial election, when Republicans did an excellent job of framing the public safety issues in New York to their advantage, Democrats have been trying to win that narrative back. And I think they've tried to confront the concerns that people have, while also highlighting that data. And right now, as an observer, I don't think that the message has permeated to the depths that they would like to see. And I think that's having an impact right now on the Democratic primary for mayor of New York City, where you have someone like former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who recently got into the race. And one of the big issues that he's highlighting that he's a capable leader on is this issue of public safety. And you have to put aside for a second that he was the governor who signed the law that changed the bail laws here in New York, which Republicans blame for some of the increased violence that we saw in 2020, 2021, some of the retail theft. So it remains to be seen how compelling of a message he can deliver on that front. But that definitely is going to be one of the issues that is top of mind for Democrats as they head to their ranked choice voting in the end of June.
Yeah. And quite frankly, right now, Andrew Cuomo's the front runner, 31% to the closest Eric Adams, right, of 11%. So that name recognition is helping there.
Yeah. You're referring to a recent Quinnipiac poll that came out this week that showed the former governor has a plurality of support in New York City amongst Democratic primary voters. I should say that poll looked at a very wide field of candidates, including some people who aren't actually in the race yet, like New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams, who was drawing a bigger share of the vote than some of the people who have been actively campaigning for nearly a year now. But like you mentioned, name recognition for the former governor seems to go a very long way. But I also think there's something beyond that. There is some sort of nostalgia for Andrew Cuomo's time in office. At the same time, though, there's also some fierce pushback to Andrew Cuomo. And as I mentioned, this is a ranked choice voting system.
Yeah.
So that's kind of throwing a wrench in our traditional perception about a race like this, because in the past, if you have a very crowded field, Andrew Cuomo is what I would say a lock to win, given the fact that he doesn't need 51% to be elected mayor. But now under this ranked choice voting system, if some people don't even include him in the top five and he's not getting that 51% in an early round of ranked choice voting, it's possible that he won't actually be the next mayor of New York City. But a lot of this is premature because we haven't even had this end of petitioning season when candidates qualify for the ballot in New York City, which is going to give us a much better picture of what the actual landscape looks like and how these campaigns are progressing.
Yeah, now we go to the governor of New York, Governor Hochul. Speaking of polls, one of the recent Siena polls had her favorability numbers down, not doing well. I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was lower. And, you know, that's an issue. And with that said, now you have the lieutenant governor, Antonio Delgado, the former Hudson Valley congressman, basically first disagreeing with Hochul on whether Biden should stay in the presidential race. Hochul said yes, Delgado said no, and now basically saying, I'm not going to be your lieutenant governor anymore, and hinting that he's willing to get in the race. And then the governor's office saying, well, we weren't going to have him back anyway.
Yeah, there's two parts to this story. There's the part that doesn't matter, and people here in Planet Albany love, which is the drama, the fact that the lieutenant governor has been stripped of his executive office and is now basically working out of a very small space in the state Senate's offices. And he has basically a computer and no staff. And that whole drama is very exciting to us here in Albany. The more substantive part of this is the fact that he is now exploring his options for 2026 and could be a candidate for governor. I would say it is a long shot bid he would be launching, because at this point, sticking with Siena College research polls, the last poll that asked about him, 18% of Democrats found him favorable, 12% viewed him unfavorably, and 70% just had no opinion on him. So it's not like he brings any serious name recognition. And now that he is on the outs with the governor, he's going to have a hard time fundraising. He's going to have a hard time garnering support for any sort of challenge. And I wouldn't necessarily want to be Delgado at this point, since he has a very uphill climb ahead of him if he does want to be governor. And honestly, I don't really see anything else for him to run for in 2026. But he is a relatively young guy in political terms. He believes in his late 40s, and given the fact that we have a president who's about 80 right now, it looks like he's got 30 years of politics in front of him. So anything's possible in the long scope of history.
We're speaking with David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room. David, also the host of WCNY's public affairs television program, Connect New York. We're so happy to have him with us today. Now, an issue that sort of was reignited in central New York, your stomping grounds, my former stomping grounds, when it came to the Marcy Correctional Facility and the fatal beating of Robert Brooks. That was a big issue, and we've seen more fallout from that, including another death of a 22-year-old. Now, not at the same correctional facility, but a nearby one. And while that's happening and all the criticism is coming out and corrections officials are being laid off and fired, the issue of the guards themselves now coming out and striking and claiming they're being mistreated.
Yeah, there is a lot going on in the prison system right now, and it's really shifted the conversation around the prison system since the December beating death of Robert Brooks, because leading into the legislative session in January, I think there was a consensus that the murder of Robert Brooks would probably serve as the catalyst for some sort of reform of our prison, potentially some new oversight measures. But it appears to be serving as the catalyst for a large, almost system-wide strike by thousands of corrections officers who walked off the job illegally under New York state law, right around the time that multiple correction officers were set to be indicted for the murder of Robert Brooks. Now, while the prison guards have said the timing has nothing to do with that, as an outside observer, you have to think that the two events are connected. This strike has been a huge problem for the prison system here in New York. The governor has responded by sending in the National Guard. She's utilized state police for some exterior security. Civilian employees in the prisons have taken on larger roles. It's been a real problem, and it's a story that is still developing because officials representing the prison guards have been meeting with members of the Hochul administration to strike some sort of deal through mediation, and there's something that is being considered now by the union officials for approval, many of whom have gone back to work, but there are still some holdouts, and you mentioned that some have lost their jobs. The corrections officials in New York earlier this week basically said, if you're not back by Monday, you're out of a job and your health care is shut off retroactively. What remains to be seen is how the union officers more broadly embrace this latest deal, because there seems to be dissatisfaction with the union leadership. And in the past, we think of them as being the voice of union members. Just less than a year ago, 75% of the prison guards signed off on a new contract for the union. So one would think the union officials were doing a good job at that point, speaking up for them. But now there's a real concern about factionalism and what's going to happen moving forward, because I don't think a lot of these underlying concerns are being addressed with the mediation that's going on. I would say this is akin to a finger in the dike, and other holes could pop up, and we could be revisiting these problems later on. And as a result, coming back to the start of what I was saying, there doesn't seem to be here in Albany that same appetite for progressive reform of the prison system. And you may see things that are more inclined to roll back or curtail some of the progressive changes that were adopted in recent years, such as changes to the use of solitary confinement.
David, I'm going to ask this question. I don't know the answer to it. It just dawned on me while you were talking. Do we have any idea whether the strike was already planned for the guards at the prisons, or whether it might have been as a result of some of the guards getting caught in these abusive situations?
Yeah, we don't really have a good sense of that, in large part because while this was definitely organized to a certain degree because we saw some union guards in Western New York facilities step down from their posts, it wasn't en masse. It ended up gaining steam. So this was obviously something on the mind of some of the prison guards, and it seemed to have a bit of a snowball effect to the point where then thousands of guards across the system were striking at one time. And again, the guards themselves have not acknowledged that it has anything to do with the death of Robert Brooks. Rather, they point to some of the trends that they're seeing in the prison system. And one of the things that I think actually contributed to this was a memo that went out from the head of the state prison system, which basically said, okay, 70% staffing is the new 100% staffing. And this is kind of a recognition that New York already has some of the highest staff to incarcerated New Yorker ratios. And there are a shortage of staff for some of these facilities. So they were basically saying, you need to get used to doing this with less than what you previously would have thought was the full staffing. And this really infuriated union members all over the state, to the point where they've had to backtrack on that memo, and that is no longer their position.
We're speaking with David Lombardo on the Capital Connection. I'm David Giustina. David, let's talk a little bit about one of the guests you've had on your program. That's the Capital Press Room. You can get there at capitalpressroom.org. And you had a wide-ranging discussion with Dr. I hope I'm saying this right, Chinazo or Chinazo?
Dr. Chinazo Cunningham, head of the Office of Addiction Services and Support.
Tell us more about this, because it had to do with halfway houses, and tell us what MAT, M-A-T, in prisons is right now.
Well, yeah, I'll stick with the prisons element of the story, because we're just talking about it. Well, you want to address people with substance abuse problems, and it's hard to sometimes make that care directly available. Well, a lot of people in the correction system have some sort of drug problem, and they are in a contained setting where you have access to medical services. And so this idea of using medication to address substance abuse problems is very popular, and they're trying to expand access to that in correctional facilities. Well, what we've heard during this strike is that incarcerated New Yorkers have had limited access to basic privileges that we might think of as routine: hot meals, showers, and I made the assumption that that also would mean medication-assisted treatment might be disrupted. The commissioner was unable to confirm that this was the case, but it's safe to assume that since other medical treatment was disrupted during the strike in facilities all over New York, it's probably safe to assume that this medication-assisted treatment that people rely on to combat their drug abuse also was disrupted. And if I could just mention that other issue you brought up, the regulation of halfway houses.
Yeah.
I was shocked to learn during our conversation that New York has these halfway houses, these facilities where people are really trying to transition to a life away from substances, and that they are not really regulated by the state. In large part, that's because they're not a clinical setting, and it's more about peer support. But what the state is now doing is this voluntary certification process where you're basically going to show that you're meeting certain standards, and that's going to make you eligible for additional state funding. So what the state is doing here is basically not requiring that you get certified, but doing kind of a carrot approach and saying, if you are willing to meet certain standards, if your care, if your programs are up to snuff, we're going to make money available to you. And I think this is something that people in the recovery space think is going to be really important to making these halfway home services better and maybe improving the response to, say, the opioid epidemic or the overdose problem that we're seeing more broadly.
Well, speaking of, we also have marijuana. It's a legal industry now in New York, recreational. We've had medical for a while. There are some issues there that we're hearing about now in terms of allowing more people the option. But when it comes to the marijuana market, you recently had a conversation where you talked about something called the inversion problem.
Yeah, New York's marijuana system, the recreational marketplace, was set up with this idea that we were going to have basically the entire supply chain here in New York, from seed to sale, so to speak. So your products would be grown in New York, they'd be processed in New York, and then they'd be sold in New York. Well, that plan has been disrupted by some of the processors, these middlemen who basically take the products that are grown on farms around New York and then get them to the retail space. And what they've been doing, allegedly, and I'm inclined to believe it's happening pretty widely based on the people who are in my ears, is processing products that have been grown outside of New York. There are a lot of states that have legal marijuana as well as illegal marijuana, and it's being grown there and shipped to New York. Regulators in New York State, that's from the State Office of Cannabis Management, say they have a zero tolerance policy for any of this so-called inversion. To date, though, based on our conversation a few days ago with the office, they haven't actually penalized anyone for this by banning them from New York, but they seem inclined to up their presence in this space and trying to ensure that only New York products are ending up on shelves in New York.
Yeah, one of the things I've encountered in my conversations with medical marijuana doctors and others in the industry is another issue, David Lombardo, which is the idea that there are two different forms of testing. So if you want to get your recreational product in the New York market, it's a less rigorous testing regimen than it is for medical. And what you end up seeing is way more options on the recreational menu than there are for the medical patients, who, if you think about it, if there's a person with a certain condition that qualifies for a medical marijuana, you would want to have more options for your medical issue than less. So it seems, talk about inversion, that they're pushing way more the recreational market than treating the medical market as a treatment for legitimate medical issues.
Yeah, there are a variety of problems with the rollout of the medical marijuana marketplace, and we've been seeing them for 10 years now, and the idea of too rigorous of testing compared to what's happening at the recreational side of things is just one component, including this idea that people are giving up the medical products because the recreational products are cheaper, and the fact that there aren't that many medical sites located all around New York compared to the way retail dispensaries are popping up. So the medical space is basically calling out for additional support from the state legislature and state regulators. But the response has largely been lawmakers playing the world's smallest violin, in large part because the people that are in the medical marijuana space are much larger companies than some of the players in the recreational market. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of sympathy for these large players. They will say, though, that we are struggling with some of the same issues, and we're going to have to keep closing our doors if we don't get some relief. And it's going to be the medical patients who are left out in the cold.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Our guest has been the wonderful David Lombardo. David is, of course, the host of the Capitol Press Room, also the host of WCNY's Public Affairs Television program, Connect New York. David, a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks for being in the trenches and covering the news that impacts so many New Yorkers, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Thanks for being my number one hype man, Dave.
You're welcome. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.